Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on the program, aid for Afghanistan. The EU pledges more than $1.4 billion Canadian after a G20 summit as the country faces a humanitarian crisis. But why no Canadian pledge? And what about the Canadians still trapped in Afghanistan, desperate to escape? The International Development Minister, Karina Gould, joins the program in just a few moments. And then, anti-vax staffing shortage. Hospitals and long-term care homes across the country are coming up against vaccine deadlines. Is a major staffing shortage the next pandemic hurdle for healthcare workers? We'll ask Ontario's long-term care minister and a hospital CEO who's already fired dozens of staff. Plus, 410 loses a court battle. The former head of Canada's vaccine rollout has lost a federal court bid for reinstatement. Does Major General Danny Fortin have any path back to the forces? We'll ask his lawyer. That and lots more. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. A $1.4 billion pledge. That came out of this morning's G20 summit on the ongoing Afghan crisis. But that pledge comes from the European Union. Now, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was part of the summit where leaders unanimously agreed that there's an urgent need to tackle the growing crisis there. But Canada did not pledge any money at the summit. So will Canada do that? And where does the federal government stand on its pledge to resettle 40,000 vulnerable Afghans to Canada, which the Prime Minister did raise in the summit call? Let's find out. Joining me now is the International Development Minister, Karina Gould. Minister, great to have you on the program. And congratulations, by the way, on the recent election win. The EU came to the meeting and they pledged $1.4 billion in aid to Afghanistan. Did Canada know that pledge was going to happen? And if so, why didn't Canada add any money to the pledge?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the program, Evan. I'm delighted to be speaking with you today. The short answer is that today's G20 summit wasn't a pledging conference, but we obviously welcome this substantial pledge from the European Union to meet the overwhelming needs of the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. Canada had already pledged an additional $50 million in August to respond to the crisis in response to the appeal from the United Nations, and we'll continue to work with our partners and allies if there are greater needs. And I can assure you that Canada will continually assess that and step up if needed.
This was hosted by the Prime Minister of Italy. Okay. Your Canada's position, and I know you've reiterated, is that this is not a pledging summit. But if it's not a pledging summit, the EU came to the table with $1.4 billion in aid. So I'm going to ask you directly, did Canada know before the summit that the EU was going to come with new money?
No.
So why wouldn't the EU have informed you and your colleagues that they're going to come to the aid? Like, you know, it's very rare that there's an international summit and a group of countries literally kind of shock the other countries, because isn't it a little embarrassing when the EU says we're coming with 1.4 and we're coming empty handed?
Well, it was an opportunity for countries to make announcements if they so chose. I mean, we reiterated our commitment to resettling 40,000 Afghan refugees and encouraged other countries to do the same. But as I said, you know, we welcome this. It's a substantial pledge to deal with the humanitarian crisis that is occurring in Afghanistan. And so while it wasn't a pledging conference, I mean, we certainly welcome the EU's initiative because we all need to be working together to respond to what is a growing, dire situation in the region.
But respectfully, Minister, you're clearly not working together. 27 countries, the EU, supposedly some of our closest allies, have pledged $1.4 billion and they didn't even bother to pick up the phone and tell Canada about it till you arrived at the meeting? Like, isn't that that's a problem. Doesn't that send a sign that Canada's been left out here?
Well, it's different than 24 countries, because she said that was in addition to the pledges that Germany, France, bilateral countries had made previously. So, no, we have been in close coordination and talking to each other. And as I said, this is a welcome announcement. It's not something that I think we should be concerned about. It's $1.4 billion, which adds to, you know, the other hundreds of millions of dollars that the other donor countries have contributed. And the needs are great. But, I mean, 50% of Afghans are in need of humanitarian assistance. So I actually think this is really good news, Evan.
I mean, I guess it's good news from the capacity for the people of Afghanistan, but I'm sort of refracting it through the political lens in Canada. Now that the EU has surprised Canada and Canada didn't even know about it, is Canada now preparing to make a contribution to the same issues? That is, I know we've done the 50 million a while ago, and I know we've got the 40,000 refugees, but the G20 specifically wants border management capacity in other regions. Is Canada now going to match some money and invest some money to support that?
Well, so we have, as you mentioned, pledged that $50 million, which is providing life-saving humanitarian assistance. I mean, you know, just today I was reading in a report that they're worried that up to 2,000 additional children are going to die each month in Afghanistan because of a lack of access to nutrition. So we're all playing parts that are coordinated, that are complementary. When it comes to resettling Afghan refugees, Canada's taking a tremendous leadership role, and we're encouraging other countries to do the same. The EU is much closer to Afghanistan geographically than Canada, but we're also working with neighboring countries to ensure that they have the supports that they need as Afghan refugees arrive in their countries. But, you know, this is something that we're working on together, and that's why today's G20 meeting was important, to ensure that we do have that coordination, we are working together, and that our efforts are complementary.
And I get you talk about being working together and collaborating and working closely, but clearly something's missing here. Can I just ask, frankly, did you ask Prime Minister Draghi, the Italian Prime Minister who chaired the meeting, can someone tell us why we didn't expect this to be a pledge meeting? 27 countries have pledged $1.4 billion. No one told Canada about it. Did you ask why no one informed Canada that their major announcement would be coming out of a meeting that Canada was part of?
And I think Canada is not part of the major announcement. A mountain out of an anthill here.
I don't think $1.4 billion to help Afghans is an anthill.
But it's not a big crisis. I mean, I think it wasn't a pledging conference. No other countries pledged additional resources. Canada's not alone in that regard. But it is a welcome announcement. I mean, it is a good thing that the EU is stepping up in this way. You know, I speak with my EU counterpart, Yanis Linarczyk, on a regular basis, whether it's with regards to Afghanistan or other issues. This morning, for example, we were on a call with regards to the crisis in Ethiopia with our U.S. counterpart as well. So that conversation is ongoing, but different countries use different moments to make announcements, and they don't always tell the other ones exactly what they're going to be doing, but we still welcome this announcement because at the end of the day, it's about helping the people of Afghanistan and making sure they have access to those emergency supports that they need that are going to be life-saving. And so from our perspective, this is a good thing.
Okay, two last things. How do people make sure? The Taliban's a terrorist organization. People still need to help the Afghans who are in a humanitarian crisis. How does Canada make sure that any money we give in any kind of aid does not end up in the Taliban hands due to whatever, corruption, the fact that they control it, the fact that they may be exerting control over an aid agency? What's the guarantee that the Taliban never get hold of that money?
Well, so we have worked in many difficult contexts for many years supporting humanitarian endeavors right around the world. I mean, Afghanistan is no exception to this. I mean, the Taliban have been active and present even before the fall of the Republic, and we were able to get humanitarian assistance into the regions that they controlled de facto. You know, neutrality and access, there are key principles when it comes to humanitarian assistance. Our resources are going through trusted partners like the United Nations, like the International Committee of the Red Cross, that are ensuring that the assistance is getting to the people who need it.
Finally, how soon what's the process for resettling the up to 40,000 Afghans in Canada? How far along are we on that?
Well, as you know, we have already resettled over 3,700 Afghans in Canada. We've approved 9,500 applications, and we are working in a very difficult context to try and assist people who have gotten out of Afghanistan, who perhaps are in neighboring countries or who have been able to get out to countries like Qatar. We're working to resettle them here in Canada, and then we're still working with people who are in Afghanistan who have been approved to get to Canada. As you'll recall, the evacuation efforts and resettlement for the Syrian refugees took several months, and I anticipate that, you know, that will be the case here as well, as we process people and try to get people out of Afghanistan safely so that they can make their way to Canada and their new lives.
International Development Minister Karina Gould, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan.
All right, let's turn our sights to the provinces now. Today, BC's new vaccine mandate for long-term care staff kicks in. LTC staff in that province will be placed on unpaid leave if they have not received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Ontario has a similar mandate set for November 15th. Unvaccinated long-term care staff will be barred from work if they aren't fully vaccinated by then. The province has also announced $4.9 billion over 4 years to boost long-term care staffing levels. But will that be enough to offset the unvaccinated staff forced out of their job? Let's bring in Ontario's long-term care minister, Rod Phillips, to ask, and he had a big announcement today. Minister, always a pleasure to have you on. I'll get to the long-term care facility that you announced today, sir, but your government gave a deadline of November 15th to long-term care workers to get vaccinated. According to the government, as of August 31st, about 44% of long-term care homes had staff vaccination levels below 90. Has that number increased since your government announced the vaccine mandate for LTC staff?
Evan, it has. The most recent figures, and just receiving them, so this is fresh information, 81% of homes have over 90%. Our average vaccination has gone up since the announcement of the mandate, so we now have 94% of long-term care staff with one dose of vaccine and 90% with the full dose. So I think that's good progress. We have to remember, in Ontario, a number of homes independent of our mandate, which we set out 2 weeks ago for that November 15th date, were proceeding with mandates of their own. So we're obviously seeing the benefit of that. But so far, I think things are unfolding well. There are going to be some cases. You'll remember when we announced the home-by-home statistics, and I had those collected as of July 1st, because I wanted to understand not just the averages, but the outliers. We have a small, relatively small number of homes with low vaccination rates. And so we're also focusing on those homes.
What's the backup measure if after November 15th staff are fired? Is there enough staff to make up for what could be some real serious looming layoffs?
So we're working with homes, particularly the relatively small number that have that larger unvaccinated population. And again, we're seeing good progress in those areas. But we are in a position to support homes where they need that support. I was out today at Seneca College with about 30 new PSWs. We have almost 11,000 personal support workers by the end of this calendar year coming through our accelerated training programs. So we do have quite a large surge of really qualified and really motivated staff to help fill those gaps. But listen, staffing in long-term care has been a challenge, not just in Ontario, but across the country. So we're keeping an eye on it very closely.
Yeah, and I know, just so folks understand, there's $4.9 billion over 4 years to hire 27,000 more long-term care staff. $270 million is earmarked this year. So do you have a number how many you can hire this year?
Yeah, that's about 4,000 additional staff this year. And that is part of our commitment to get to four hours of care. So that is going to be 4,000 additional ones this year. But we also have to make sure that we maintain the current staffing level. So, you know, health human resources is a real challenge across the province. It's one of the reasons we've increased our nursing enrollments. It's one of the reasons we're paying tuitions for PSWs. So this is an area of real focus, not just in Ontario, but across the country.
Your government announced today the creation of a new long-term care home in Vaughan. That's north of Ontario. 256 long-term care beds created by 2026. I guess this is a plan to sell that unused government land with the condition that a portion of the land is used for long-term care. What is the minimum percentage of land that's required for developers to create long-term care spaces? And is this the beginning of a lot more spaces or not?
It is. We have about 220 construction projects underway right now and about 20,000 beds in development. But one of the challenges, particularly in the GTA, is the cost of land. So what we committed to was to look to surplus government land. This was some land that the government of Ontario bought in the 70s. I asked because I thought someone might ask me, what was it bought for in the first place? Nobody remembered. But now it's going to be dedicated to those 256 beds. We have another announcement similar to that that's coming up soon. So this is, you know, we're pulling out all the stops. If government land can be part of making this happen, that's going to be important. But by and large, these are projects, whether it's not-for-profit, for-profit, or municipality, municipalities that are building those 20,000 beds. That's something that's going to make a real difference.
Okay, I got to ask something slightly outside of your chalk lines here, but Ontario, of course, we've heard is negotiating with the federal government on a different kind of care, not long-term care, childcare deal. The federal government's promised $30 billion allocated over 5 years. We understand there's some debate going back and forth. Of the $30 billion, how much does Ontario want? Like, what would be the line that Ontario needs to sign on?
Well, I was with Minister Lecce, our Minister of Education, today because the announcement was in Vaughan, and that's where his riding was. And he was talking about what we need, which is a fair deal. I have to understand that we have about 40% of the population, and of course we're not going to negotiate even on power play. If we could do it anywhere, we'd do it here, Evan. But it's important
that there be enough to
have a sustainable program. You have to remember in Ontario as well, we have junior kindergarten, which is another fully funded program already paid for by the provincial government. So we have some things that other provinces don't have. So my understanding, and as you said, it's not in my chalk lines, but my understanding of those conversations are ongoing. We just want to make sure we get a fair deal, something sustainable, and that we can provide childcare at a reasonable cost for parents.
Right. Okay, so just confirming, you're negotiating with the federal government, and the line that Ontario is talking about is, we're 40% of the population on this, we want 40% of the cash. That's basically what you're talking about.
Well, what we need is enough dollars to provide a sustainable program. The federal government has made a choice about putting a certain amount of money on the table, and we always welcome our partnerships with the federal government, but it needs to be dollars that accomplish the objective. And they've set out the objective, so we're working with them to say, how much money will it take to accomplish that objective? And that is in addition to the supports we already provide, the child tax credits we provide. But this is an area of ongoing conversation with the federal government. And, you know, I know we look forward to continuing to work with them. Obviously, they're getting a new cabinet in shape, and we understand that that's a transition that takes some time.
All right, I got to leave it there. Ontario's long-term care minister, Mr. Rob Phillips, great to have you on the program.
Thank you, Evan. Take care.
Yeah, you too. All right, coming up, Major General Denis Foltest strikes out in court. The Major General lost his bid to get his job back as the face of Canada's vaccine rollout. What are his next steps? We'll bring his lawyer in next. Stay with us. A federal court judge has ruled against Major General Denis Foltest's request for reinstatement as the head of Canada's vaccine distribution campaign. In her ruling, Justice Anne-Marie MacDonald writes, quote, I conclude this is an appropriate case for the court to exercise restraint. Major General Foltest must exhaust the internal grievance process prior to seeking a remedy in this court. In other words, the judge is siding with the government lawyers who argued that the acting defense chief, General Wayne Eyre, acted correctly in removing Foltest amidst a military police investigation in his conduct, dating back to an alleged sexual assault in 1988. Again, in August, let me remind you, Major General Foltest was actually charged by police in Gatineau, Quebec, with one count of sexual assault. Foltest has denied any wrongdoing. None of the allegations have been proven in court. So where does the Major General, does the Major General still have a path back? And what happens now? His lawyer, Natalia Rodriguez from Conway Litigation, joins us now. Ms. Rodriguez, always a pleasure to have you back on the, court, on the program. I know you represent Major General Foltest in his federal court application to be reinstated with the Public Health Agency of Canada. I know you're not part of the criminal case as well. He lost. Where does he go from here? Can he appeal the ruling?
Well, let me just clarify one thing, Evan, that you mentioned, and that is that you had stated, and I have to say incorrectly, that he had lost his bid to be reinstated and that the court had sided with the government, that the acting chief of the defense staff had acted reasonably in removing him. In fact, none of these allegations have been determined at all. What happened was the court agreed with the government that Major General Foltest was in the wrong forum. So we say he had a right to go to the federal court to argue his case. The government said, no, if he has an issue with his removal, he should go to the military grievance process. And the court agreed with the government. That's the only thing that's been decided in this case. So whether or not it was reasonable to remove him, whether or not he was afforded the appropriate procedural fairness has not been adjudicated at all. There's been no decision with respect to those issues.
you know what? Fair point, Ms. Rodriguez. You're absolutely right. But now what happens? So he can't adjudicate this in the federal court. He's got to adjudicate it through the military process. Is that right?
That is what the court has determined in today's decision. Now, we are looking at the decision carefully. We are reviewing it. We don't agree with the decision. Our position has always been that the military grievance process cannot determine the issues that were raised in this application. You have to understand the heart of the application is that the ministers, the Minister of National Defense, the Minister of Health, the Prime Minister of Canada, and the clerk of the Privy Council jointly and severally made the decision to remove Major General Fortin from his position. And so our position is that the military grievance process cannot quash a decision of ministers because it doesn't have authority to do so. It is only meant to deal with decisions made within the military. And so we disagree with the judge's decision today. That's right, and we disagree with the court.
So where do you go from here?
Well, like I said, we are looking at the decision carefully. We are determining whether we appeal the decision. That is always open to a litigant at the federal court that has an unfavorable decision. And so we'll be reviewing that decision carefully and determining next steps with our client. But we continue to be of the view that it is not possible to review a decision of the ministers in this case.
Okay, so you stand by the notion that the decision to pull him was essentially potentially a politically motivated issue. Can I just ask, I know you don't represent him in the criminal matter. I know, and he's been charged with one count of sexual assault by the Quebec prosecutors. Nothing's been proven in court yet. Would that have any bearing on whether or not the military or whoever has the right to say, given that those charges exist, we do not want him as the head of the vaccine rollout?
Well, the criminal charge could potentially have an effect on whether or not he is removed from military duty or relieved, rather, from the performance of military duty. And that's essentially what happened in this case. He was de facto relieved from the performance of military duty, but without the appropriate procedural safeguards. So it's not that the military can't say, we want to remove you because of whatever issue may be the case. It could be an outstanding criminal charge. It could be a complaint. It could be whatever the case may be. The issue is that the appropriate process has to be followed. And in this case, that didn't happen. So to relieve somebody of military duty for example, an allegation, an investigation, or a charge, the person affected, the officer, would have a right to know what the basis for the potential decision would be. So they would receive a letter saying, we are considering relieving you from military duty for these reasons. Then the officer would have an opportunity to make representations and say yes or no, or this is my position with respect to what this letter says. And then they would be entitled to written reasons within 24 hours of the decision. So it's not that the military could not have made a decision. First of all, it had to be made within the military, which it wasn't. In this case, it was made by the ministers, as I said. And second of all, the appropriate process that is in place and is meant to deal with these situations should have been followed. And in this case, it was not followed. Now, if after a proper process, the decision is to relieve him from the performance of military duty, then that's a different situation. But that's not what happens here.
Natalia Rodriguez, Conway Litigation. I appreciate you taking the time to explain all this. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you. All right, stay with us. He became one of the most famous public servants in the country. Michael Wernick has a new book out. The former clerk of the Privy Council got a guidebook for public servants. But you probably know him. He warned that our political climate could get so bad that someone would get shot. And yes, he is the man that Jody Wilson-Raybould secretly taped for 17 minutes during the SNC-Lavalin scandal. And he joins us next. Welcome back. Most people across the country likely don't know Canada's top bureaucrat, the clerk of the Privy Council. He's the person who serves the Prime Minister and is in the room in so many critical meetings. But Michael Wernick, the former clerk of the Privy Council, is an exception. Mr. Wernick served three prime ministers throughout his long and distinguished career. But during the SNC-Lavalin controversy, his explosive testimony shocked the country. He said he was, quote, deeply concerned about the politics in the country and where we are headed. He said, quote, I worry about the rising tides of incitements to violence when people use terms like treason and traitor in open discourse. Those are words that lead to assassination. I'm worried someone's going to be shot in this country this year during the political campaign. And of course, he also became famous when it emerged that Jody Wilson-Raybould, the former Liberal Justice Minister, had secretly taped a conversation with Michael Wernick for 17 minutes, and he became central to that SNC-Lavalin controversy. It eventually led, of course, to Jody Wilson-Raybould being booted from the Liberal caucus. So why is Mr. Wernick back in the news? Well, guess what? He's written this new book. It's a guidebook to public servants, and it's called Governing Canada, A Guide to the Tradecraft of Politics. Well, he joins us now to talk about that and lots more, the former clerk of the Privy Council, Michael Wernick. Sir, a pleasure to have you on the program, and your book is fascinating. As you know, you became famous for other reasons. We just finished a campaign, and I'll start by asking you, are you still worried about the direction of politics? Are you still concerned about, quote, an assassination or that someone will get shot?
Well, Evan, I'm going to just correct your intro. It's actually a guidebook for cabinet ministers and prime ministers. The thrust of the 200-page book is about how cabinet government works in this country. We have a unique Canadian model. I think a lot of Canadians assume it's something like the United States or Britain. And I have a perspective, having worked so closely with several governments and being in the cabinet room about 250 times by my rough count, to try to shed a little bit of light for people that are interested in government and politics about how cabinet works and what it is that prime ministers and ministers do all the time. But to get back to your question, I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is clearly the price of coming into public life and serving your country is going up. And, you know, as we continue to have elections, we've had 8 in the last 21 years, I would be worried that it's going to be harder to attract good people to come and serve the country.
And is the climate, in your view, getting worse, more polarized? Or have you seen, because of the warning, any of the politicians on the political side? And I'll, by the way, I will get to the book, which I've read, and there's lots in it. But are you worried things are getting worse?
Well, I'm a retired guy and a consumer of news programs like yours, so I don't have the inside perspective that I used to, where I was well aware of the just vile threats and abuse that were sent to ministers, MPs, political staffers, and you know, all the things I've seen in the public discourse suggest that's only gotten worse over the last little while. It's not unique to Canada. It's happened in the UK and Germany and France. It seems to be a feature of modern politics. And the question is not whether we have that virus of polarization. It's, you know, do we have the antibodies to do something about it?
Well, that's going to be the question. Let me get to the book on this. In order to fight to produce the antibodies, you need good governance. And this is what a lot of this book is about. One of the things you talk about, as the clerk, you're giving advice, but you're looking at the relationship on the political side, the cabinet's relationship to the prime minister, and you talk about how robust those discussions can be, but they're protected by confidentiality. I assume you, as the clerk, when you're speaking to a minister, think you are protected by confidentiality. Was it corrosive to find out that a senior minister was so distrustful of what was going on that she taped what you're doing? And if so, what does that do to the kind of governance that you talk about in this book?
Well, that was certainly the view of the rest of the cabinet ministers and of the caucus and led to the decisions they took. I was certainly taken aback by it. Your point about cabinet confidence is really important because I think because a lot of the conversations inside the cabinet room are out of view and out of sight, people assume they don't matter or they don't happen. There's a caricature that's often brought up that ministers are sort of robots or sheep told what to do by the all-powerful center. And that's just not my experience. Strong and effective ministers actually win arguments at cabinet. They talk their colleagues and prime ministers into things and out of things. And they give a voice, as the caucus meetings do, to backbenchers. All of these mechanisms of coordination and collective government are actually a way for all kinds of people to influence the outcomes.
Mr. Wernick, Jody Wilson-Raybould's point is that people like you and others are using cabinet confidence to cover up for essentially bullying or improper activities. That when she taped you about the deferred prosecution agreement and you said to her, I think the Prime Minister is going to find a way to get it done by another means, giving SNC-Lavalin a deferred prosecution. So he's in that kind of mood and I wanted you to be aware of that. She said, I was taping it because they were crossing a line and trying to improperly influence the Justice Minister. So I felt I needed to tape you because by relying on cabinet confidentiality, she believed you were crossing a critical line. And so was it her right to tape if she thinks things aren't going, being used right, that cabinet confidentiality is used to cover up, in her view, improper behavior?
Well, let's go back and be clear that none of the important events in this whole story happened inside the cabinet room and were a matter of cabinet confidence. The only time anything to do with this came before cabinet was when the Minister of Justice brought a proposal to cabinet recommending on her signature that Canada take up the tool of deferred prosecution agreements. She sponsored that MC and spoke in favor of that. And it was ultimately brought into Canadian legislation by Parliament. There's no other time when the matter was discussed at Cabinet until she left.
I know we got a Jason Kenney coming up, but I wish I had a long time with you. But what is one of the things in this book, sir, you talk about, people need to know this, not just the public, but as you say, the practitioners. What is the most misunderstood thing about the relationship between the bureaucracy, which you saw in the United States is sometimes called the deep state by some conspiracy theorists. Others think, oh, the power of the Prime Minister's office is so good, they're essentially sheep and lemmings. What don't we get about those caricatures?
I think there's always a very dynamic back and forth discussion among ministers within the government, between senior public servants and ministers. There's a tendency to see the public service as some kind of independent cadre. The public service is there to help an elected government with a democratic mandate deliver and implement the things that it has the mandate to do. And a lot of the conversations are not about whether to, I don't know, legalize cannabis or bring in carbon pricing or raise the GST or, you know, they're about how to get there. There are thousands of tactical decisions that are required to move towards, the goals that you've set as a government. And you also have to make all kinds of political decisions because you have to build the coalitions and the support and the messaging and all of the things that will ensure that you actually can get there.
Listen, Mr. Wernick, this is a fascinating book, Governing Canada, Guide to the Tradecraft of Politics. You know these programs mean we rely on live news, and Premier Jason Kenney of Alberta has got a very key COVID update that we've got to go to. I really hope we have a chance to have a longer conversation. I found the book fascinating, and I always appreciate the conversation, sir.
I will yield to the Premier, and I'd be happy to come back, Evan. Thanks for your interest.
Okay, please do that, and I appreciate it. You yield to no one. Okay, let's go to Jason Kenney in Alberta right now.
Alberta is doing good work to close in on the national vaccination average, with more than 85% of eligible Albertans having received first dose coverage. That's up from 78% just over a month ago, which means that over 250,000 Albertans have stepped up to get at least a first dose of protection. And to them, I want to say thank you. Altogether, more than 3.2 million Albertans have decided to protect themselves, their loved ones, and our healthcare system. You are making a difference with those choices. In fact, Alberta has moved from being about 10 points behind the Canadian average for first dose coverage to within 2% of the national average. I also want to thank each and every Albertan who followed the gathering limits this Thanksgiving weekend. While we still have a ways to go, we are seeing some encouraging trends, which means that the restrictions exemption program, together with other vaccine incentives and public health measures, have had a real and positive impact. Every Albertan who chooses the protection of vaccines is one less person who might end up in our intensive care units or hospital beds, which means less pressure on our system. We're still facing canceled surgeries, and ICUs are well over their typical baseline capacity, which means that there is less care available for people with other pressing medical needs. A COVID-19 vaccine is the best way to ensure that there's a bed for you or your loved one if they have a serious medical issue like a car accident or a heart attack. To put it bluntly, there are currently 1,053 Albertans hospitalized with COVID-19, and 73% of them are not vaccinated. And from those 1,053 in hospital, 242 Albertans are in intensive care with COVID, with almost 90% of them being unvaccinated. Vaccines work, period. Alberta's restrictions exemption program, our proof of vaccination system, is based on this basic and obvious fact. When we launched it on September 20th, it was about ensuring Albertans who choose to protect themselves and others can safely do as many things as possible without public health restrictions. That's because if you are vaccinated, you pose a much smaller risk of spreading COVID. And if you're exposed to it, you face a dramatically lower chance of a severe outcome like hospitalization or death. The numbers here in Alberta bear this out. For example, every single Albertan under the age of 40 who has lost their life to this virus has been unvaccinated. That's why today I'm announcing steps to make it easier and more secure for people and businesses to participate in the program, the REP, and to limit the spread of COVID-19. As of today, Alberta's new verification app to scan proof for vaccinations with a QR code is available for download on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. Businesses and organizations can immediately use the free app at Alberta COVID Records Verifier to quickly and easily check the authenticity of a vaccine record. Albertans can get their enhanced vaccine record with a QR code online at alberta.ca/COVID records. That's alberta.ca/COVID records. There is no need to create an account. All you need to do is enter your Alberta health card number. When a valid QR code is scanned, a green check mark will verify the proof of vaccination. It's that easy for businesses and Albertans participating in the REP. And it's important to note that the app does not store any personal information for privacy purposes. This new QR code verifier app is in addition to the REP implementation grant that we announced last week, which is a $2,000 payment available to businesses to help offset the costs of implementing and participating in this program. And the REP training grant is also providing funding to businesses to help train their staff on how to safely and professionally request proof of vaccination, similar to the ProServe program for alcohol service. I'm pleased to say that these new programs have made Alberta the first province in Canada to provide financial support for businesses who choose to require proof of vaccination. We're doing everything we can to ensure as many Albertans are protected from COVID-19 as possible. With that, I'll turn it over to Minister Copping to provide more details, and we'll then be hearing from Chief Medical Officer Dr. Hinshaw and AHS President Dr. Yu.
Okay, that is Premier of Alberta, Jason Kenney, giving the Alberta COVID update. Okay, and we'll be following along there as that situation remains very serious. A year ago, Canadians banged on pots and pans to thank Canada's frontline healthcare workers. Some of those frontline healthcare workers, we cheered on, and they could be out of a job, though. Why? They didn't get the jab. Today marks the deadline for BC's long-term care workers to have at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. Those who refuse will be placed on unpaid leave. Now, in Quebec, nurses who refuse to get a COVID-19 vaccine by Friday not only face being laid off, but could also have their licenses suspended. In Ontario, the Ford government has mandated November 15th as the deadline for long-term care staff, as we just spoke about with Minister Phillips. But there's no such vaccine mandate for Ontario hospitals. So can Canada's already overburdened healthcare workforce afford to lay off more workers? The Press Gallery is here to take that up. Bob Fyfe, the Globe and Mail's Ottawa Bureau Chief, is here. Emily Nicolas, a columnist with Le Devoir. And our special guest is David Mouchet, President and CEO of the Windsor Regional Hospital. Great to have everybody on the program, and happy Thanksgiving to all of you. Let me start with you, Mr. Mouchet. Good to have you here. BC and Quebec are preparing to lay off some healthcare workers. Your hospital's already fired 57 employees and suspended six professional staff who failed to get the jab by last Thursday. First of all, how much of an impact did that have on your day-to-day services, and what rationale did these folks have for not getting it?
Good evening. Thank you for having me. Well, I think we also got to focus on the fact 4,155 of our staff did follow the policy and did get vaccinated, which is 98.5%. Everyone wants to focus on the 57 and the additional six professional staff that did not follow the policy. But in large part, 99% of our nurses followed the policy. 99% of our physicians, dentists, midwives, and nurse practitioners followed the policy. So we are, by doing so, leading by example. We have all stated that getting the vaccine in along with public health measures, adhering to them, are the two most important things to do right now. And we have to lead by example as healthcare leaders in our community as well as for the province.
But can you just tell us, you still fired 57 and suspended six. So has it had an impact on service?
No, not at all. And you got to look at it again. You're looking at that. You got to look at the impact of having unvaccinated individuals caring for immune compromised patients, our highest risk individuals in our society are coming to our hospital and are at highest risk. The goal here is how do you minimize that risk? How do you do it through a layered approach? So yes, you could say 2 years ago, these individuals, we didn't have vaccines 2 years ago, but now we do. So how do you layer that on to the PPE, the social distancing, carbon dioxide examinations, ventilations, et cetera, and layer that on to minimize risk? So we minimize the possibility of an outbreak occurring in the hospital where someone who came into the hospital who has nothing to do with COVID contracts COVID and unfortunately dies. We won't eliminate it, but we're going to minimize it greatly by doing this.
Okay, Bob, what's your take on A, how long it's taken to enforce some of these mandates, but how, well, you listen to what's happening in Windsor, how key it might have to be?
Well, look, I think it's Windsor is, took the right decision, and I think the Ottawa General Hospital here, for example, is going to do the same thing. You know, hospitals have to take action if the governments won't, because as your guest just said, we cannot have unvaccinated nurses in hospitals potentially spreading COVID amongst patients who are there because they're sick. This is an absolute necessity that our hospitals make sure that people are in working there are fully vaccinated, but the other side of the coin is that we do have to properly compensate our nurses. They're not paid enough. We've all talked about how wonderful work and how brave they've been during this COVID crisis, but the fact is that their wages have been held down by governments, certainly in Ontario, but also in Alberta, for example, and at least Quebec government is compensating them with potentially up to $8,000 in bonuses for them to work. I think we really do need to see government step up and pay our nurses more money.
Yeah, it's interesting, Emily. Quebec's taking the same hard line. What do you make of that? How's that going over in Quebec?
Well, it's a tricky exercise because there is a shortage of health hospital staff. So here, the mandate that's going to take place on Friday is for nurses, auxiliary nurses, pharmacists, and doctors. And so there's a lot of people that are, that might be impacted by it. And so there's people worry that in some units where people are already under capacity, people being unable to work might worsen the labor shortage. On the other hand, as Bob was saying, just the fact that Quebec government has been trying to lure some nurses back into hospitals by those cash bonuses might actually help mitigate some of that risk. So it's really a thing where we know ethically, morally, it's the right thing to do because of the risk that it poses to immunocompromised patients. At the same time, there might be some other risks that are posed by people leaving or not being able to work. And so it's really a policy in which the devil is in the details, and we're going to see how it works, I guess, next week, based on which hospital, which region. It's going to be very much a region by region, you know, healthcare service by service accession of whether or not the policy had the effect that we wanted.
What's the sense, and let me just go back to, about this threat to revoke the license to practice, which is what Quebec is doing, which I think is just it's a huge thing. David, what's your sense of that? Is that too far?
Well, it sure sets the message and the tone. And again, what we're seeing is those jurisdictions that set that message and set that tone do get those results. So it is dramatic, but it just shows how important getting the vaccine and public health measures matter. What's that William Shakespeare quote? Doing nothing gets you nothing, or something like that. Status quo is not going to work. So we have to do something. This is the right thing to do. And all the hospitals are now moving towards this. And we are seeing an increase. When we started having these discussions with our staff, our vaccination rates were about 85-88%. As we started mandating this, and as we said, this is coming, and gave them notice, that's when it shot up. Even 2 weeks in our unpaid leave time period, we started at 147 and got it down to 63. So even for that 2 week period, we had 80 plus staff get vaccinated just for those 2 weeks.
Yeah, you will gain nothing if you invest in nothing, King Lear. You know, little English 101. Bob, how do you refract this through the lens of politics? Because all the political parties support a vaccine mandate, except one, the Conservatives, who are still struggling on that. Now you see where Quebec is. Now you see where CEOs like David is. How does that play out?
Well, look, even in the Globe and Mail, we had a editorial meeting with the publisher, and people have we have given, I think it's a week and a half or 2 weeks before everybody has to be fully vaccinated. If they're not, they're going to be fired. I hope that politicians will set the example in Parliament by doing what the Bloc Quebec Wall leader said. If you should not be able to sit in the House of Commons for 10 sessions in the House of Commons and come into the House of Commons unless you're fully vaccinated. This is not a joke here. People are dying from COVID. We've 85% of the population are fully vaccinated, and there's a percentage of that population that are resisting it, and some need to be told very clearly that if they don't get fully vaccinated, they're going to lose their work. They're not going to be able to travel on planes or trains. We can't fool around. This has gone on for over a year and a half, and I think people are losing their patience.
Yeah, and Emily, does that revocation of the license have support across Quebec? Because that is now the biggest stick in the country.
Yes, I think this is something that people support. And I also think that, you know, we're so focused on COVID-19, but a lot of people in the healthcare system remember very well how they had to get vaccinated against so many different diseases just to be able to practice. There is already a precedent of having to get vaccinated about basically everything else to be able to work as a doctor, or to have that as a condition to be able to work in a hospital. And so it's new that it's the case for COVID-19, but it's not new that healthcare professionals need to be vaccinated. And so I think if we were to frame it like that a little bit more and normalize basically what's going on, because it is normal, I think we would have a response to what's happening that is less maybe politicized.
Yeah, and I should just say, I think David Mouchet's point is great. Most of the hospital workers, by and large, are. Even in Quebec, 87% of the eligible population has at least one shot. Over 80 has two shots. Bob Fyfe, Emily Nicolas, and David Mouchet, I appreciate what you're talking about. But the vast, vast, vast majority of Canadians, well over 80 to 90%, are in that one two-shot dose who are eligible. So as David rightly points out, there's a few that aren't. Okay, the three of you, I always appreciate you joining us. Thank you so much, and I hope you had a good Thanksgiving, and I'll see you very soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That is your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank all of you for joining us today. Lots coming up, obviously. We'll be following the fallout of that Afghanistan meeting. Canada didn't make the pledge, but the European Union pledged $1.4 billion. So lots of news to come. We will be back here in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones. It's a great privilege if you can do that. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.